Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Hey, I hope you're having hot fun in the autumn time, Jeff.
On today's show, we remember Ron Hodges. But first, the Hall of Fame ballot has been released for the class of 2024. There are five Mets under consideration for the first time and five Mets holdovers.
This is the easiest ballot I've ever had to hypothetically fill out. We've got 10 Mets on the ballot. I'm punching or checking, I suppose. It's not an all-star ballot. I'm checking the boxes for all 10 because what else do I have to be interested in where the Hall of Fame is concerned? Are five newcomers, all of whom played their last major league game in 2018, are Adrian Gonzalez, Jose Bautista, Bartolo Colon, still playing in Dubai, I think, but it's not the major leagues, Jose Reyes, and of course, the captain, David Wright. And they join, as you said, five holdovers: Carlos Beltran, Bobby Abreu, Francisco Rodriguez, Billy Wagner, and Gary Sheffield, who I believe is on his last attempt to get into the Hall. 10 Mets. Now, mind you, some more Met than others. You are forgiven out there if you've forgotten that Adrian Gonzalez, who was a terrific run producer for the Padres and Dodgers primarily, was a New York Met, but he was the last year of his career, 2018, for at least a month or two. And Jose Bautista came by to play a little outfield and third base for the Mets in the middle of the 2018 season, hit a walk-off grand slam, and did what appeared to be Tai Chi between batters in right field, which I remember because I once had seats literally behind him and watched him stay loose. So those fellas may not strike you as Met icons. Of course, Bautista grew to fame and fortune as a Toronto Blue Jay. The bat flip is probably what people remember about him in the postseason of 2015 when we were kind of preoccupied. And you know, the great Bartolo Colon. I don't know how many fan bases wish to say, hey, he was on our team. Probably half of them in the major leagues. I've lost count. But he became a beloved figure while he was pitching for the Mets for three seasons. Fine pitcher, lest we forget that, on top of his power hitting exploits and fielding and everything that made Bartolo Bartolo. But really, the two main guys here, I think that we would all have an interest in as Mets fans who are on the ballot for the first time, Jose Reyes and David Wright. How beautiful that they go on the ballot together. I don't know that they will stay on the ballot together. Jose, for the first 10 years of his career, was as dynamic as any player in baseball, as far as I was concerned. Hands down, best all-around shortstop in Mets history. The stolen base king of his time, the triples king of his time, a fantastic fielder in his time. Slowed down the second half of his career as he left New York, came back, not the same player, but helped the Mets to the postseason when he came back in 2016 and had some off the field problems, I think it's fair to say, but left on a good note. And you can't think of Reyes in Mets terms without thinking of David Wright. And you can't think of the New York Mets for very long without thinking of David Wright. I mean, I think we're in anything that doesn't start with one of the greatest players in New York Mets history is underselling David Wright. And really, it's one of those things where if we talk about his Hall of Fame credentials, whatever they are, they match exactly what he did as a Met, because he was only a Met. We haven't had too many of those guys spend an entire long career as a Met, as David Wright did. And you know, again, at his peak, which was pretty long, David Wright, one of the top two or three third basemen in the game, one of the best hitters in the game at his best. Problem is, kind of fell off physically mostly, and really that day-to-day production, just that day-to-day presence that he had for about a decade, kind of evaporated. And you know, we know the struggles he went through just to get back on the field at the very end But it was a hell of a night when he went out to third base with Jose Reyes out at shortstop. It was September 29th, 2018. It could have been any time from 2004 to 2011. So all the fields, as they say. Whether that cuts ice with 5% of Hall of Fame voters, I'm not sure. I'd like to think that with the contingent that covered him in New York, that saw what he was all about, hopefully giving him a check mark to keep him on the ballot, to get him talked about, get him thought about in that way that I think players who had that kind of career deserve to be considered. I think that would be great. If he's not going to be elected ever, I guess there's always that other side of it where you say, well, why keep me hanging on? As Kim Wilde said, and I think the Supremes before that, and Vanilla Fudge for that matter. So it just shows that we have all lived a long time if David Wright and Jose Reyes are on a Hall of Fame ballot for the first time.
David Wright, that people are speculating that he might not get 5%. And I was horrified because you need 5% of the votes to stay on the ballot. And to me, I was incredulous. The only question, as far as I'm concerned, is he going to get in or isn't he? Not whether he's going to get past that 5% threshold. But it shows you the disparity between how we feel about David Wright and how everyone else perceives of him, because he didn't play for that long in comparison to many others, including his Virginia Beach sidekick, Ryan Zimmerman. And David Wright was a great player. His career WAR 49.2, but we always hear with Hall of Fame voters, well, he didn't play for a long time. That's what prevented Dale Murphy from making it. Well, you and I have advocated for Dale Murphy, even though he wore the Braves uniform. David Wright was a great player. Are we rewarding longevity more than what they do on the field?
I think a lot of people, to use that universe of a lot of people, or too many people, look for reasons to keep people out of the Hall of Fame rather than find a way to usher them in. And maybe there's something to be said for, oh, we have such an incredibly high standard. How could the Hall of Fame be for anybody but the best of the best of the absolute best? For long enough with a lot of players who aren't in. I have felt I'm watching the best of the best of the very best. Maybe that bestness, shall we say, only lasted X number of years. I think that there's something to be said for share of consciousness as a baseball fan, that if a baseball player got in your head for many years saying, oh my God, he's one of the best players in the game. I love watching this guy. I'm super aware of this guy. I'm voting for this guy for the All-Star ballot, the one where you did punch a little box out every year. I think there's a lot to be said for that. I think that's why we cling to Dale Murphy as one of our ideal candidates who's not in. And other names I could throw out from the past who may or may not ever get in, guys like Davey Concepcion and Steve Garvey, and players who just sort of faded from the ballot. David Wright, had he stayed healthy, would probably have numbers that would make people who don't care about him the way we do take a closer look. Right now, I think he's probably somewhere between that. Well, it's enough that he made the ballot, and boy, it's a shame he didn't play longer and excel longer. I mean, he did have 14 seasons, but one of them was literally two games. One of them was the approximate half season when he first came up. And immediately, by the way, immediately was a terrific player. There was like almost no adjustment period. From 05, his first full year, to really through 13, he missed a little bit of time in the second half that year, and he missed a bunch of time with the bad back the first time in 11, and of course, the unfortunate Matt Cain fastball off the head forced him to miss probably not enough time, probably should have sat out longer, but. That's nine full seasons plus 2004 plus 2014, where again he missed some time, but basically got a full season in. So we're talking about a guy who had the equivalent of about 11 full seasons, maybe 10 if you take out a few games here and there, 10 and a half, we'll say. one of the better players in the National League during that time. Listen, the case was made successfully for Scott Rolen, who went in last year. It is not a great leap to say David Wright was that kind of player. Maybe not quite the defensive player, but certainly up there with the production, had more speed, was absolutely a team leader. We call him the captain for a reason. And so not to say, Scott Rolen had some defect to him or whatever. I mean, I will admit I never watched Scott Rolen the many times I saw him play for the Phillies, Cardinals, or Reds at Citi Field or Shea Stadium and said, wow, there's future Hall of Famer Scott Rolen. But I became convinced when the case was made. I think Wright was on his way to that kind of career. It was curtailed. We saw what he could do when he willed himself back in 2015. We saw him hit a home run in the World Series. We saw him hit a home run his first at bat coming back from that long layoff that August. Thing is, he is more important to us than he is to anybody else. Listen, Todd Helton is growing toward enough votes to get in. Entire career with the Colorado Rockies. I would not begrudge Colorado Rockies fan one iota if that's what they're interested in. If all they care about is why aren't more people voting for Todd Helton. I'm not as interested in Todd Helton. I'm not as interested in Adrian Beltre, who is probably the one sure thing on this ballot. I mean, he ought to go in. Would I remove one of the 10 Mets from my ballot to put Beltre in? No, because I'm a Mets fan. What do I care? But if I was being one of those dispassionate writers who had a vote, of course I vote for Beltre. Right at the very least, if you were not a Mets fan, presents an interesting case, a borderline type of thing, one of those words they throw around. One of those worst words they throw around, all a very good phrase I've really grown to disdain, as if being very good is to say you're just not good enough for this discussion. Again, just as a fan who wants him to stay in the game, stay on the ballot, I hope he beats 5%. I hope he gets in the double digits. I hope somehow that would auger some sort of momentum, and maybe he'd be on the way up. Some of the holdovers have been.
Greg mentioned Matt Cain of the Giants beating David Wright. I remember one year I was visiting my son in San Francisco. We went to an excellent deep dish pizza place. They had a Matt Cain pie and there was a Matt Cain uniform. And I took a picture of it and emailed it to Greg with full knowledge of what Matt Cain did to David Wright. And immediately Greg replied to me, "Do they throw the pizza at your head?"
I'm laughing because I don't remember that, but that's a good line. Matt Cain pitched a perfect game, won some World Series rings, had a heck of a career. Unfortunately, he has this on his record as far as we're concerned. And it's a shame that it, got into kind of the way of David Wright's career, probably. Remember that was 2009, the first year where David Wright was not a particularly productive batter as he was coming to grips with the weird dimensions comparative to Shea of Citi Field and the whole team struggled that year. But he came back the next year, put up David Wright numbers. And by 2012, what would be really his last full, completely healthy season, he finished high in the MVP voting for a lousy team, by the way. He was the, 12, he in 2012, he was the all-star backup to Pablo Sandoval. 2013, Citi Field, host of the All-Star game that year. David Wright is, along with Matt Harvey, the center of attention. We got him voted on to the All-Star team. He headed up the home run derby team for the National League. He was named captain that year. Just all those things we love about him, or we love to remember about him, and just, the way he went about his game. And the fact that he was, for me personally, that he was running mate and vice versa to Jose Reyes, who remains what I call my last favorite player. I don't think I've really had a quote unquote favorite player since Jose Reyes. And, Jose Reyes was the kind of player who, unless he was going to really pile up the numbers, was in retrospect going to run out of steam because he was such a speed oriented player. but a slashing batter. And certainly in the early part of his career, that smile lit up Shea Stadium, and to a lesser extent, Citi Field, culminating in his batting title, the first one a Met had ever produced. It was a sad day for me when he left the Mets to sign with the Marlins, because you knew they, I mean, I could not fathom that they would let him go, and yet, as soon as you heard the numbers of what he was getting from the Marlins, unfortunately not getting a no trade clause, you knew that the Mets in the Madoff era were not going to re-sign him. And again, when he came back after some a rough start in Miami, had actually a pretty good season, had some good years with Toronto. They weren't very good, but then they traded for Troy Tulowitzki. They go to the playoffs. He's miserable in Colorado. We know about the domestic violence charge, or the at least the accusation, and how that resolved itself. And for some people, made Jose Reyes persona non grata, and I understand that. But he is still with his significant other, and he came back, and he was grateful to come back. And again, I when I think of Jose Reyes's second act, that Astrubal Cabrera game, everybody I would hope remembers, with the arms raised in the air, the 11th inning home run, the 9-8 win en route to the wild card. Jose Reyes made that possible with a big home run in, I want to say, the 8th inning, maybe it was the 9th inning, but him and Cespedes and Cabrera put together this like incredible team within a team down the stretch. And it was great to be reminded of what Jose Reyes could do and who he could be. And with Wright on the sidelines, he was that link again to the last good times at Shea Stadium. Because we're talking 8 years after Shea Stadium, and the last couple of years less and less productive and effective. But again, if I had one wish going through the 2010s, it was that someday David Wright and Jose Reyes would be back on the left side of the infield together. And it really happened. For everything else the Mets mishandled in those days, the fact that they got David Wright back on the field, and the fact that they had Jose Reyes still on the roster, and that we could watch them together and embrace together and essentially retire together, was a wonderful coda to the time they spent putting up what could have been, had everything broken right, legitimately Hall of Fame careers. I don't expect Jose to stay on the ballot, unfortunately. I assume Bartolo Colon will stay on the ballot. He has probably a lot of goodwill in a lot of places, has more wins than any Latin American-born pitcher, which is to say a lot of wins, close to 250, I believe. And he, again, pitched great for us, pitched great for Cleveland, pitched well for a lot of teams, won a Cy Young for the Angels. So I think he's a guy who, such a singular figure, who is going to attract some attention, because I don't think the ballot is jammed full of, when every writer writes his or her, "Oh my God, what are we going to do? There's so many candidates," columns. I don't think we're going to be subjected to that many of them this year, thank goodness. I can't speak for how much attention Bautista will get. I mean, he's, like many people's girlfriends, he's big in Canada, shall we say? And he probably deserves some consideration. You can make what you want out of Adrian Gonzalez. Again, he was a dangerous hitter and around a long time. For what, when Mike Piazza came back to Shea Stadium with the Padres, remember Adrian Gonzalez batted in front of him. And at the time, I don't think I knew too much about Adrian Gonzalez, and he was still around a dozen years later to play for the Mets, split some time with Dom Smith. Just to show how time flies. So that those are the new guys. Again, you can't blame us. We're Mets fans. Right is our priority, and we, again, if we could go, we could go in the back, grab some ballots, and check them off on his behalf. I'm sure we would.
Jose Bautista was an all-star for six straight seasons. In 2011, he was third in the MVP voting. He had 43 home runs, 103 RBI. In 2010, 54 home runs. But that was as a Blue Jay. He played 302 games as a Met. No more memorable game than the walk-off grand slam against Tampa. in 2018, which incredibly was his first career walk-off home run. Who would have thought that for someone with such a outstanding career?
Timing is everything. If you hit 54 home runs in a season and they come from the first to the eighth innings, or they come in the ninth inning with a large enough lead or unfortunately a large enough deficit, that's okay too. So no, Jose Bautista, again, he's just one of those guys who existed in highlights for me until 2018. Probably not as aware of him as I should have been, because I live in a National League town in my mind, and I don't spend a lot of time watching the Blue Jays, who, again, for most of his career there, were a little shy of the playoffs. But he certainly put up the numbers. Listen, if you can be part of a championship team, that probably helps your cause. Carlos Beltran, part of a championship team, not the one that's put in the nicest terms by a lot of fans, the 2017 Astros. But that was, again, the topper of the cake, or whatever cliche it is I'm groping for here, that said that Carlos Beltran, who had came up, the end of 98, and he goes out in 17, 20 years. And his numbers were fantastic, and his impact was fantastic wherever he went. And he probably be very close to getting in this year if he wasn't already in on the first ballot, had it not been for the sign absconding that he was, the one name that was stuck by any player of any player with Houston in 17 was Carlos Beltran. So he may be paying a price for at least a little while. I would have to think, based on the fact that I think he got 45%, something like that, in his first go around, he's probably on track for a good day in Cooperstown. If not this year, then pretty soon.
Yeah, I think Beltran deserves it. A special advisor to David Stearns, Carlos Beltran. I think he will eventually get in, but the voters are still remembering his involvement with the Astros scandal. As far as Reyes goes, we will still have the memories of him turning on the Jets at going from second to third, while the ball's with a ball in the gap, and when it looked like he just hit a double, but he would just turn it on and apparently get faster going to third and making it safely in for a triple. With Colon, I think the body of Colon has eclipsed the body of his work, because I feel that we find him to be a jester who hit that home run. He jiggled his belly, and as you said, he was a very good pitcher. And of course, David Wright, we keep our fingers crossed. Hopefully he will get past that 5% and some momentum will build.
Yeah, Bartolo Colon was a dead serious figure when he was on the mound. And I don't think in his lengthy prime, which went on for a while, batters anticipated an easy day against him. Again, the one guy we haven't yet mentioned who may very well have his number called in January, Billy Wagner, is getting really close to going in, which is interesting just as an observer, because this says something about relief pitching that, when I saw the Baseball Reference WAR figures for everybody on the ballot, I think the two guys who were way down there, at least among the holdovers, were Billy Wagner and Francisco Rodriguez, because I don't think WAR is designed to necessarily compare relief pitchers to everybody else, given what they do in the game and how little they participate in innings, an inning here and an inning there, versus guys like David Wright, who play nine innings at a clip every single day. But very important innings, as we know, and Billy Wagner was a guy who, talk about who batters didn't want to face, especially when he was with Houston, and somewhat when he was with the Mets, certainly had the saves by number as a Met. And I think it will, again, this is one of those things that seems to have taken on its own kind of momentum, the case for Wagner, who I just get the feeling a generation or so ago might have been one and done on the ballot, but has really jumped up there. in his time under consideration. And if we are to look at players at their best, very few relievers in the National League were better than Billy Wagner, more lethal than Billy Wagner. He pitched in the same era as Trevor Hoffman. Trevor Hoffman is in, and he'd probably be the only guy who would get named before Billy Wagner in any given year as the best relief pitcher in the National League. And because I still have a soft spot for Francisco Rodriguez, I'd like to believe that maybe Wagner's case lifts Rodriguez's up a little more. He managed to stay on the ballot again during that same period, maybe a little later, but they certainly overlapped. Rodriguez was, you could say, the American League equivalent of Wagner, just a guy who could come in and just end at bats in three pitches. And he also has a ring that Beltran has, and I guess Wagner doesn't, if that means anything. He was so important to those 2002 Angels as a rookie, as an unknown quantity, as a secret weapon. So that to me will be fascinating to watch. And the other two guys, Bobby Abreu is one of those aficionado type candidates. If you really value the things that Bobby Abreu could do, especially the on-base percentage, I hope I'm not getting this wrong. I remember him being having a really good arm early in his career. I also remember him not being that great fielder, but later in his career. But the on-base stuff was amazing and really made himself one of those under-the-radar players every year. He was just in that. Remember when we were kids, they talk about Joe Rudy, most underrated player in baseball, when Fonzie was at his peak. It was like Edgardo Alfonso is so underrated. I think that was Bobby Abreu's portfolio, and now he's taken it to the Hall of Fame ballot for a few years. I'll be interested to see if he gains any traction. And Gary Sheffield, last year on the ballot. Again, when we talk about, wow, that guy was good, I can't think of too many players who frightened me more as an opposing batter than Gary Sheffield. And to me, even though it was the end of his career, it was just so exciting to see him in a Mets uniform and to see that angry swing of his and what it could produce, especially the first part of his 2009 with the Mets, when he, still had real thunder in that bat. Not a defensive specialist by any means. And maybe it took him a while to mature through the years, and he made a lot of stops, all those things. Modern ball player. I think, again, his association was with Balco, probably held him back somewhere along the way. And I'd be surprised if he makes whatever leap is necessary. But again, to me, even if he'd never been a Met, I'd be thinking, how is this man not in the Hall of Fame? They could say that about a few guys who've been kind of held back by certain allegations. Don't want to go all the way up and down the ballot, but as I was just looking at the candidacies, I was like, oh, that's right. Alex Rodriguez is not in the Hall of Fame, and he's probably not going to get in the Hall of Fame right now. And it's like, my God, Alex Rodriguez, I know what he is, suspensions and everything else. He was one of the greatest players who ever played. And Manny Ramirez, one of the greatest hitters who ever hit. It's too bad. People are going to feel, writers, voters are going to feel they don't know how authentic those totals are. And, under other circumstances, they and a lot of other people would have already gone in and probably would have made the whole process a little easier for the players like Carlos Delgado and Johan Santana, we've talked about in the past, guys who deserved more of a look, certainly, than one and done, which is what both of those guys were, which is insanity, quite frankly. And whoever else is on the ballot, hopefully, I would love to see, with the exception of Chase Utley, I would love to see everybody get one vote at least to say, hey, look, somebody remembered me. Because listen, to get on a Hall of Fame ballot, first off, you spent 10 years in the big leagues. And secondly, you've excelled to some degree. So even if you don't have like a real shot at getting in, it would be nice to say, now maybe that we're past, how could you waste a vote on this one when that one is so close or whatever? All things being equal, I'm all for committing a vote to a guy who isn't going to get a vote otherwise. It would probably be monopolistic practices for all the writers to get together and figure that out. But some guy voting in Minneapolis wants to arrange to vote for somebody in some other city because he wants to make sure that he gets a return vote for Joe Mauer. That'll be fine with me, but it doesn't really work that way. But again, it's I have to say, I'm always impressed when I look at the names on a Hall of Fame ballot. I don't think that should be understated. Great careers, and it's a little sad to say, oh, he's never mind him. He wasn't really that good. Hall of Very Good. Next. Oh, take a moment. I would suggest take a moment, scan those ballots. I don't mean take them to your polling place and scan them, but I mean, look them up and down and say, wow, those are some good players. Try to remember something about them. I mean, you got a long way to go till spring training. It's something to do.
One thing you should not do is vote for Chase Utley, who is an assassin and does not deserve a single vote.
Yeah, let's see what we can do about that, huh?
As far as Billy Wagner, I think that the voters are still not clear about how to handle saves. Is it important? Is it not important? I think he will eventually get in. But let me ask you this, Greg. My opinion is that there is an anti-New York bias by writers to counteract a perceived New York bias. I think that happens with MVP voting, Cy Young voting, Rookie of the Year voting, Manager of the Year voting, and the Hall of Fame. I think that many non-New York voters feel that the New York related candidates have already been the beneficiary of so much publicity because they are from New York that they counterbalance that by not voting for them because they think that they're. Those players' careers have been pumped up out of proportion because they are in New York. So now they're going to counteract that when they can by voting against them. Do you think that's possible?
Is that why Aaron Judge has an MVP and a Rookie of the Year, or is it just the Mets we're talking about?
I think Aaron Judge is an exception.
Okay. I think that's healthy paranoia to a certain degree, but sometimes, I mean, listen, we are parochial, we are provincial in what we do as fans and doing this and whatever else we, going through our lives as Mets fans. I think, we are so focused on somebody like David Wright that we can't believe that more people aren't as aware of how wonderful a career David Wright had. But I've admitted I'm not super conscious of how wonderful a career that players in other places have had unless they are just overwhelmingly great. Does New York, does having the New York tag on them somehow work against them if it's 50-50, well, I could vote for this one or that one. Well, I'll vote for the guy from Cincinnati or whatever. I really don't know. It's odd to think of New York being, having a disadvantage given that it's New York, baby. I think back, you've made me think back to this 1981 Lawrence Taylor's rookie year, which I was in Tampa in college, so I was not privy to every Giants game as I would have been otherwise, but I learned, like, oh my God, the Giants have this great linebackers and this fantastic. They're saying he's redefining the position. And at the time, the Buccaneers, had a great linebacker, Hugh Greene. And I remember reading in the papers down there, oh, Hugh Greene doesn't get the attention Lawrence Taylor does because he's not from New York. It's the New York media bias. And I had kind of the same thought then that you've expressed now, that what New York bias? I've been a Giants fan for, at that point, a dozen or so years. And nobody was talking about how great this Giant and that Giant was in the present tense because they were a lousy team and they didn't have great players. So I think, and we probably do the same thing. We'd probably say, oh yeah, Los Angeles, what's that Hollywood nonsense all about or whatever. And you know what, we're fans. We can do that. You would hope the professionals, the people who are entrusted to make these calls, are looking at it probably from every angle, And I, you know, when you read these garment-rending columns that they write, you know, I'm pretty sure they're not just saying, "Hey, let's see, David Wright, Jose Reyes, oh, they played in New York. I don't like New York. New York gets too much attention as it is. Give me Joe Mauer, real heartland type of guy." I mean, yeah, you don't know what goes through every single voter's heads. As far as things like Rookie of the Year and Cy Young and Hall of Fame and all that, I don't really know, or MVP. No, we've never had an MVP, but we've had a bunch of Cy Youngs and we've had a bunch of Rookies of the Year. And sometimes we feel like, hey, why didn't Tom Seaver get the Cy Young in 1971 and that sort of thing? But I think we get our share. And again, I would like the Mets to be in a position where nobody has to vote on the ultimate award in 2024, and that they are unanimously selected world champions because they've won it.
Hear, hear. On Wednesday, the Mets signed Luis Severino to a one-year $13 million contract. A low-risk move for the Mets. They'll get other starting pitchers. The Mets are getting Severino at a good value because he's coming off a bad season. He had numerous injuries in 2023, but has had a solid career before that. So the Mets hope to restore him to past glory in 2024. The Mets have also named new members of Carlos Mendoza's coaching staff. The first base coach will be Antoine Richardson. The third base coach will be Mike Sarbaugh. He was with Francisco Lindor in Cleveland, so there's some familiarity there. Sarbaugh will be the one where we're staring at the screen and incredulously asking, "Why did you send him?" Or, "Why didn't you send him?" Or quietly saying, "Good send." Or good hold. Mike Sarbaugh, the third base coach, and the bench coach, former Blue Jays manager, former Met John Gibbons.
John Gibbons had an interesting brief career as a major leaguer for the New York Mets. The same draft, same first round of the draft in 1980 that yielded Darryl Strawberry, the number one pick, the New York Mets, and yielded Billy Bean, lower down the first round to the New York Mets, and Billy Bean, future general manager and Moneyball craftsman for the Oakland A's. John Gibbons, part of that same first round haul for the New York Mets. So he was one of those catcher of the future, player of the future types who we looked forward to. And he was about to meet his moment in 1984. He was going to be the starting catcher, started catching all those young starting pitchers, Darling and Terrell and Lynch and that kid out of was in single A last year, Dwight Gooden. Then he got hurt. I think it was spring training, may have been very early in the season. And never really got back his job. So he missed most of 1984. Mike Fitzgerald became the primary catcher for the surprising Mets. And at the end of that year, or in the offseason that followed, Mike Fitzgerald was traded for another catcher you might have heard of, Gary Carter. And that sort of changed the complexion of where Mets catching was going. So John Gibbons stuck around in Tidewater for a few years. Here's something that fascinates me, because I've seen him referred to, and of course his baseball reference page would confirm this, that he played in two seasons, 84 and 86. He was called up in 85 and 87, back when you could expand the rosters to Kingdom Come in September. And Davey Johnson, for whatever reason, probably because they were just, you know, fighting tooth and nail down the stretch in both 85 and 87 and wasn't about to rest Gary Carter. And if he was going to rest Gary Carter, he may have had somebody else up his sleeve than a third or fourth string catcher in September. John Gibbons didn't get to a single game in 85 and 87. But I think that might have served him well in some way, because he was on his way to a long career managing in the minor league system for the Mets and then getting that big break in Toronto and then getting called back, became very respected. Why did it help him not to catch? A lot of time sitting on the bench, a lot of time working with pitchers, a lot of time to take in his surroundings and watch the game. Again, I'm not saying that, hey, I could have played some too and done that, but Maybe that helped contribute. John Gibbons, hopefully sitting side by side with Carlos Mendoza, bringing the good advice. I think when you think of John Gibbons, in action as a New York Met. There was one play in particular you would recognize immediately if you were a veteran of great Met highlights from 1986. The 8-2-5 double play to end the game in San Diego in late August as that road trip, this great road trip, was ending. I think the Mets went 10-1, maybe 8-1, I think is more like it. Sorry about that. But they had had a, Dwight Gooden had a large lead. It had gotten away with the bullpen. They went to extra innings, and there's a hit into center field. I want to say it was Tim Flannery coming around third. But regardless, Dykstra throws to John Gibbons, who's catching, because that's those are the couple of weeks Gary Carter is on the DL when he hurt his finger playing first base, to give him a break, oddly enough. And Gibbons makes the tag. And then you can see Doug Sisk, who's on the mound backing up the plate, is pointing toward third base. And immediately Gibbons says, yeah, there's a play at third. And he throws to third. And he gets the runner. I want to say Alan Wiggins. I could just be completely making that up. I have the details somewhere, as does your computer. Anyway, 8-2-5 double play. Or as Tim McCarver so memorably said, just your routine double play. And that was, you know, again, John Gibbons was basically the 25th man on a 24-man roster for the postseason. Either him or Rick Anderson, who was a quadruple A pitcher who had given the Mets some good innings that year. I seem to remember them, you know, being on the bench, hanging around the team, just in case somebody got hurt, I guess. And they were there when the, not the rings, but the keys to the city were presented the at the end of the trip up the Canyon of Heroes, as they called players up to the steps of City Hall. I remember John Gibbons being there. So he was a part of the organization for a long time. Again, just by necessity, or at least by circumstances, didn't get much of a chance after he had his big break, which unfortunately an injury curtailed. And then again, came Gary Carter. A lot of catchers from that era would say, yeah, I played behind Gary Carter, because you weren't going to unseat him still in the prime of his career. Years ago, I think it was the first interview I ever did with a former Met by the name of Steve Springer, who was mostly a career minor leaguer, but had a cup of coffee with the 92 Mets after, I think, 6 years in the system, and was up for about a week and then back at Tidewater, or maybe Norfolk by then, and went on for another cup of coffee. I want to say Cleveland, maybe somewhere else in the American League. Anyway, he had some sort of hitting audio tape, great advice from a former major leaguer who had opened up a hitting school or something. You know, much like those interviews you might listen to on a sports radio station during Super Bowl week, where somebody has to get in a plug for his product. We basically agreed, like, let Steve Springer talk about his hitting tape, and I listened to it and, you know, wrote about it, and then he would just, you know, talk to me about his life in the major leagues and what he remembered about playing at Shea Stadium, what he remembered about playing with the Mets. And one thing stands out for me. And this is like 2006 or thereabouts. He said, because this was right after some I think it was Shea Hillenbrand had some sort of run-in with Gibbons as manager the first time Gibbons was managing in Toronto. And he said, if you can't get along with John Gibbons, something's wrong with you. John Gibbons is gold. And that's always stuck with me. That's somebody who knew him, you know, going back many years into the Met system. Spoke that highly of Gibbons, and everything, every time I've, you know, read an interview or whatever with John Gibbons or read people about him, I always think, like, he's gold. So hopefully that's still true. I'm going on one source, but he's been around. He knows the way to Flushing. Carlos Mendoza knows about the importance of a bench coach, having been one himself. So I look forward to him. The other coaches you mentioned, the ones we've talked about before, all coming together and forming this fabulous unit that is going to guide this fabulous team that we're still waiting to find out who exactly will be on it, and to do fabulous things that all those anti-New York writers can't take away. So as we talk about John Gibbons, a member of the 1984 Mets, can't help but think of another catcher from that team, catcher from a lot of Mets teams, and somebody who played a lot cumulatively for the New York Mets, who we lost over the Thanksgiving weekend. That would be Ron Hodges. As familiar a name to any Mets fan from 1973 to 1984 as there could have been, because Ron Hodges was a Met all 12 of those seasons. And like with David Wright, like with Ed Cranepool, and really nobody else in terms of a single team career and a Met career, lasted as long in a Mets uniform as Ron Hodges. And it is a unique career in Met annals. You might say Ron Hodges got the highlight of his career out of the way early. Just not a bad thing to have done, considering it was the highlight of a lifetime for a lot of Mets fans. A night we still talk about, we still remember. We just celebrated the 50th anniversary of it. Sure, it came up in some of our discussions of 1973. It's that week that the Mets are playing the Pirates, five consecutive games, three in Pittsburgh, two in New York. Ron Hodges by then was a rookie who'd been up for a few months. We know that part of the legend of the 73 Mets, the injuries, and how did they manage to hold the fort in terms of catching, because they had a big injury. They were out Jerry Grody for a long time. Ron Hodges, double A catcher, comes up, a strong defensive catcher who didn't have much of an offensive profile in his second professional year, but he was picked in the first round in 72, and they liked what they saw of him defensively, so they gave him a shot, because honestly, they had no other choice. They had Duffy, Dyer, and nobody else after a while, so it became Hodges and Dyer, and Ron Hodges did some hitting coming up. From Double A, was batting over 300 after 15 games. That ended soon enough. He had a home run, drove in some runs, but he was there to play defense and to handle that great pitching staff and to keep us going till Jerry Grody came back. And as you can imagine, once Jerry Grody comes back, it's his job again. But that series against Pittsburgh, the Thursday night, the fourth game, Yogi Berra's making moves. And before you know it, he's pinch hit for Jerry Grody. He's pinch run for pinch hitter Duffy Dyer. He's got Ron Hodges left, and Ron Hodges is going to catch extra innings. And he catches three perfect innings from Ray Sadecki until Sadecki finally puts somebody on. And it's the 13th inning, and there's two outs. And Richie Zisk is on first base. Richie Zisk is a terrific hitter, not much of a runner, but a very long fly ball off the bat of Dave Augustine follows, and it's going out. It's going, but it's not gone. It hits off the top of the fence, and Cleon Jones is right there to catch it, perfectly into his glove. Fires to Wayne Garrett playing shortstop, not third base, because again, a lot of moves that night, and a lot of players moved here and there. Garrett gets the relay, fires it home, and who's waiting at home? The rookie, Ron Hodges, and Ron Hodges. Just holds his ground. Zisk, big man, comes barreling into him, but makes the tag, holds on to the ball, shows the ball to the umpire. Guess what? Third out of the inning. Guess what further? John Milner on second in the bottom of the inning. Ron Hodges is up. Rookie, pennant pressure, doesn't matter. Single. Milner comes home. Mets win the game. They're a half game out of first place. The next night, they're in first place. And that's the 1973 Mets in a nutshell, if you had to have only a nutshell. And what an entrance into the big leagues for Ron Hodges. And like I said, that's kind of the highlight of his career. Only one of really the most memorable defensive plays and follow-up at bats you could imagine. And he has a job in New York for the rest of his life, it felt like. 1974, backing up Jerry Grody. 1975, the Mets have gotten a rookie named John Stearns, a hot prospect from Philadelphia for Tuck McGraw. He's going to be on the team. Hodges consents to go down to AAA. And he said, upon reflection years later, he's decided that ultimately he'd rather be a backup in the majors than a starter in the minors. So he went down to start in the minors for a year to get better at his craft. And by 76, really by the end of 75, but on a full-time basis by 76, he's back. It's planned sometimes. Grody is in his twilight as a Met. Stearns takes over as the full-time catcher, and Ron Hodges is his backup. I should point out, Ron Hodges is a left-handed batter. Not a lot of left-handed catchers out there, so that certainly helped him endure. A little later, Alex Trevino, fine defensive catcher, not much of a hitter, comes up. So you have to, if you are a Met manager, Joe Torre by then, you're making room for all three of them, and you're figuring out places to play them. And Stearns gets some time at third base. Trevino gets some time at third base. I think Trevino played a little second base. There was some outfield for both of them. Ron Hodges was a catcher and a pinch hitter and a veteran. It's funny how quickly that happened. Went from being the rookie on the team with Willie Mays and Tom Seaver and Rusty Staub to being, you know, the senior man, and certainly in terms of service all those years. He and Craig Swan. Swan finally left in 84, pitched a little for the Angels. So it was just Hodges at that point. You know, Hodges saw a lot of pitchers. Caught Seaver, Guzman, and Matlack. Caught Swan and Zachary and Nino Espinosa and Mark Bombach and Pete Falcone, you know, into the Ed Lynch and Charlie Paleo years. And ultimately, you know, the coming back of Tom Seaver, who was catching on opening day in 1983, was Ron Hodges. And again, the youngsters who we were bated breath waiting for, Terrell and Darling and Doc, and later that year, El Cid. Ron Hodges, part of all of that. Ron Hodges, part of that revival in 1984 after so many awful seasons in the shadows, part of the Mets team that was about to devour New York with great joy for all of us. By then, Ron Hodges is 35. Funny how time slips away. 23 when he came up, turned 24 in 1973. And you know, ultimately, Gary Carter's on his way. And you've got other catchers there to back him up. Clint Hurdle, Ron Reynolds, people like that. So ultimately, Ron Hodges is, he has an option. The Mets don't pick it up. Frank Cashin gives him a very nice send-off, says, oh, he's always been a terrific player and gentleman. It's a word I saw quite a few times as I looked into Ron Hodges and the experiences people have with him. And so that's not a bad thing to be remembered for, nor is it had to be remembered as a lifetime Met. Again, the numbers are not amazing. Guy who didn't play more than once, maybe catch once a week, twice a week, except when there were injuries, and then he caught quite a lot. Pinch hit, not a bad pinch hitter at all. So, you know, again, we were not expecting to suddenly hear that Ron Hodges was no longer with us. He was at Citi Field back in September. The Mets had a small commemoration of the ball off the wall play, or off the top of the wall, as I like to say, because that's what made it somewhat remarkable. And Ron Hodges was there. Jay Horowitz had him and Cleon and Wayne all on his podcast around that time. I'd encourage anybody to go look up Jay's podcast, that episode, any episode really. And, it was just, again, part of the fabric in a, not obscure way, I tend to think. Again, we talk about some of the players who leave us, and I feel like I have to sort of explain who they were to an audience that might not have seen them. But I think if you're a certain age, you remember Ron Hodges as a constant of what the Mets were. And it's nice to have somebody you can count on. It was nice knowing Ron Hodges was there. And yes, next time you enter Citi Field through the Jackie Robinson Rotunda, why don't you take just a second before you get up the escalator or go into the store or the Hall of Fame? Number 42 has a nice little statue there. Just the number 4 and the number 2. And yeah, we know who it's there for. But Ron Hodges wore it longer than anybody else in Mets history. And it's hard not to see number 42 sometimes and think, yeah, Ron Hodges, heck of a catcher, heck of a guy, heck of a Met.
Beautiful words, Greg. Our condolences to his friends and family. Rest in peace, Ron Hodges. Ron Hodges was from Rocky Mount, Virginia. And if you're driving south on 95 towards, say, Port St. Lucie, as you approach Richmond, there will be a divide in the road. You can stay on 95 and go through Richmond. or you can go around Richmond if there's traffic and end up in the same place. The sign to go around Richmond says Rocky Mount, Virginia. So if you're driving toward Port St. Lucie in February or March, you'll see that sign. Think of Ron Hodges. We're like the AAA here. You get Mets facts and you also get traffic news.
And we're not quite in the major leagues. That's how elsewhere like AAA.
I was thinking of the other AAA, but that's very good also. And that'll do it for this episode of National League Town. We'll be back next week with more. So until then, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Check them out on Spotify.